uses or has used to obtain location data. One relies on a company called Babel Street, which creates a product called LocateX. U.S. Special Operations Command, a branch of the military tasked with counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, and special reconnaissance, bought access to LocateX to assist on overseas special forces operations. The other stream is through a company called XMode, which obtains location data directly from apps, then sells that data to contractors and, by extension, the military. The news highlights the opaque location data industry and the fact that the U.S. military, which has infamously used other location data to target drone strikes, is purchasing access to sensitive data. Many of the users of apps involved in the data supply chain are Muslim, which is notable considering that the United States of America has waged a decades-long war on predominantly Muslim groups in West Asia region and has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians during its military operations in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Motherboard does not know of any specific operations in which this type of app-based location data has been used by the U.S. military. Some critics directed their ire in part at the companies behind the apps named in the report, including Muslim Pro, which reminds users when to pray and the direction Mecca from their current location and includes passages and audio readings from Quran, as well as the dating app Muslim Mingle. Both apps send data to XMode. Both Muslim Pro and Mingle didn't respond to Motherboard's request for comment. Central Ron Wyden told the outlet that in a September call with my office, lawyers for the data broker XMode Social confirmed that the company is selling data collected from phones in the United States of America to U.S. military customers via defense contractors. Citing non-disclosure agreements, the company refused to identify the specific defense contractors or the specific government agencies buying the data. The Trusted Partners section of XMode's website previously listed as customers the contractors Sierra Nevada Corporation and Systems Technology Research, but simple company names have been removed from the page as Wyden's office and Motherboard have conducted investigations, according to the news outlet, which noted that multiple app developers who work with XMode said they didn't know their users' location data was shared with military contractors. XMode told Motherboard by email that it does not work with Sierra Nevada or STR, but didn't deny they had been customers. Neither of the companies responded to requests for comment. XMode also said it licenses its data panel to a small number of technology companies that may work with government military services. But our work with such contractors is international and primarily focused on three use cases: cybersecurity, counterinsurgency, and predicting future COVID-19 hotspots. While Babel Street also didn't reply to Motherboard's request for comment, Navy Commander Tim Hawkins, a USS OCOM spokesperson, confirmed the LocateX purchase and told the outlet, "Our access to the software is used to support a Special Operations Forces mission requirements overseas. We strictly adhere to established procedures and policies for protecting the privacy, civil liberties, constitutional and legal rights of American citizens. Wolfie Crystal, a researcher, writer, and digital rights activist at Cracked Labs in Austria, called Marburg's investigation so far the most comprehensive report on how all kinds of mobile apps share or sell location data with data brokers, who in turn sell it to US military and defense contractors, all without the user's knowledge. The mobile app ecosystem is totally broken, Crystal added. Matteo Gargiulo, a policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation working on surveillance and privacy, joined those weighing in on the report via Twitter by writing that law enforcement and government have always had an "if the data is out there, we want it" approach. If there are apps or companies that think they can make a quick buck by selling data you shared with them, Gargiulo added, they will always find a buyer in the government.
Top Iraqi military officials, including Defense Minister Lieutenant General Juma Anatsad Unkhattab, along with the Navy, Air Force, and Air Defense commanders, have visited the Iranian capital Tehran and met with high-ranking officials there. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said the two sides discussed ways to reinforce defense and military cooperation. Bagheri further noted that during his meeting with the Iraqi defense minister, the two sides exchanged views on issues related to defense industry and security of the two countries' common borders, as well as bilateral cooperation and joint military exercises. The Iranian officials stressed the significance of boosting defense cooperation between the two neighbors, as the United States is after redeploying terrorists in the region.
A resurgence of terrorism in the region will help the United States to maintain its influence and to even infiltrate more than before in the region. And who is milking terrorist groups in the region in order to impose its will, in order to occupy, plunder, and change regimes?
The Iraqi defense chief also held talks with Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, on bilateral, regional, and international developments. Shamkhani said a U.S. objective is to create rifts and conflicts among regional states in West Asia, underlining the need for the regional countries to exercise vigilance against the sinister plot. Khattab, for his part, held Tehran's support and assistance for his country in repelling terrorism and stressed expanding bilateral relations, especially in military and security sectors. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and deputy head of Iraq's popular mobilization units Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis near the Baghdad airport earlier this year. Following the attack, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. The latest such demonstration was held last week near Baghdad's high-security green zone, where government buildings and foreign missions, including the U.S. Embassy, are located.
By assassinating the Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror heroes who literally liberated Iraq and Syria from the terrorists of ISIS, the United States was fighting against the fight on terrors. And how could they sell their weapons, warmongers in the United States sell their weapons and maintain their presence?
Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of the Pentagon's Central Command said earlier this year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The commander, however, said he expected U.S. and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
People have suffered enough, and in fact, they have demanded the United States presence termination. I think if the Iraqi government believes that they have democracy, that they have a system that can translate public opinion into laws and normatives, they should facilitate what the Iraqi parliament has already ratified.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever. Top Iraqi military officials, including Defense Minister Lieutenant General Juma Anatsadun Khattab, along with the Navy, Air Force, and Air Defense commanders, have visited the Iranian capital Tehran and met with high-ranking officials there. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said the two sides discussed ways to reinforce defense and military cooperation. Bagheri further noted that during his meeting with the Iraqi defense minister, the two sides exchanged views on issues related to defense industry and security of the two countries' common borders, as well as bilateral cooperation and joint military exercises. The Iranian officials stressed the significance of boosting defense cooperation between the two neighbors, as the United States is after redeploying terrorists in the region.
A resurgence of terrorism in the region will help the United States to maintain its influence and to even infiltrate more than before in the region. And who is milking terrorist groups in the region in order to impose its will, in order to occupy, plunder, and change regimes?
The Iraqi defense chief also held talks with Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, on bilateral, regional, and international developments. Shamkhani said a U.S. objective is to create rifts and conflicts among regional states in West Asia, underlining the need for the regional countries to exercise vigilance against the sinister plot. Khattab, for his part, held Tehran's support and assistance for his country in repelling terrorism and stressed expanding bilateral relations, especially in military and security sectors. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and deputy head of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis near the Baghdad airport earlier this year. Following the attack, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. The latest such demonstration was held last week near Baghdad's high-security green zone, where government buildings and foreign missions, including the U.S. Embassy, are located.
By assassinating the Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror heroes who literally liberated Iraq and Syria from the terrorists of ISIS, the United States was fighting against the fight on terrors. And how could they sell their weapons, warmongers in the United States sell their weapons and maintain their presence?
Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of the Pentagon's Central Command said earlier this year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The commander, however, said he expected U.S. and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
People have suffered enough, and in fact, they have demanded the United States presence termination. I think if the Iraqi government believes that they have democracy, that they have a system that can translate public opinion into laws and normatives, they should facilitate what the Iraqi parliament has already ratified.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever.
Not so long ago, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia was stood on the stage at the Nobel Hall in Oslo, receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in achieving peace and international cooperation in resolving the border dispute with neighbouring country, Eritrea. Move forward to today, and the Ethiopian Prime Minister is refusing to enter any form of dialogue over an ongoing ethnic conflict in the north of the country, with some allegations now suggesting that war crimes could be being committed in the region as the battle rages on between the Ethiopian military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The United Nations lead on human rights, Michelle Bachelet, has stated that the situation is spinning out of control, leading to heavy casualties, destruction, and mass displacement of people, something that the region is very much ill-equipped to cope with, leading to a potential humanitarian disaster. But for the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Ahmed Abiy, he's making very serious claims that the Tigray people are responsible for acts of treason and terrorism, something that has seen the conflict see the Ethiopian military step up their efforts in sending resources to the region to quash the notion. Yet it seems that the scale of the operation is causing disturbing reports emerging from the area, with witnesses claiming that they've seen Ethiopian forces bombing civilian areas, as well as ground operations that have seen shooting on the streets, as well as machete attacks. So what is the real source of this conflict, and why have tensions escalated into a full-blown civil war, in spite of pleas by the international arena to halt the fighting?
When the current Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, came to power in 2018, he decided that he was now going to eliminate this old structure, and he proposed a new party called the Prosperity Party, which would not be based on any nationality, not Tigrayan, not Oromo, not Amhara, etc. And the TPLF rebelled and didn't want their power challenged with this new structure.
What now remains to be seen is whether the fighting will cause a conflict to spill over into neighbouring countries, something that could lead to further issues in the region. Ethiopia is no stranger when it comes to seeing masses of people flee from its nation. The 1980s saw famine force hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians away from their homeland in search of food and water. And yet again today, the same dilemma is in force, yet this time with people fleeing conflict. Estimates have already placed over 14,500 people, half of whom are children, as fleeing the conflict zone, with many of them heading to Sudan, with aid agencies stating that more could follow as the situation becomes worse. With the tensions now spreading outside of the Tigray region in the form of an attack on an airport in the neighbouring state, the notion that refugees could start abandoning Ethiopia from other parts of the country could have a detrimental effect on the region and could draw in the presence of neighbouring countries into the fold. Yet as the conflict escalates and no sign of diplomacy is on the immediate horizon, the situation in and around the Horn of Africa could escalate into a regional war as neighbouring states and international actors form alliances and allegiances based on their own goals, setting off yet another disaster in a region that should instead be embracing a post-colonial peace.
Britain and the European Union face another fast-approaching deadline to conclude marathon talks on their future relationship. December 31st is looming, but the remaining differences are apparently still very significant. The two sides are trying to hammer out an agreement on their future ties that will include a crucial trade deal, security cooperation, and rules in areas like fishing access. The talks are tough, with each side pushing to get the other to make more concessions. Battered by the devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic, businesses in Britain urgently need a trade agreement that would minimize disruption in January when the country officially exits the European trading system. But top EU officials are taking a tough line on Britain and are unwilling to budge. A summit of EU leaders on November 19th is widely seen as the final deadline for a draft deal. The situation has piled pressure on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who was a key architect of Brexit. He seems to be scrambling to make trade deals with other nations like the United States to make the UK less dependent on a deal with the European bloc. He has used the possibility of clinching trade deals with other countries as a bargaining chip in talks with Brussels. Johnson wants to get the EU to believe that Britain can easily survive even if it leaves the bloc's trading system without a deal. He has long been pinning his hopes on a fast-track free trade deal with America. Boris Johnson was among the first world leaders to congratulate Joe Biden soon after media projections showed that he won the presidential race. Critics in Britain and the U.S. have dismissed this as insincere, as members of Johnson's cabinet and Tory lawmakers had openly supported the re-election of the incumbent president. Things will probably be a lot different if Biden takes office in January. Unlike Trump, Biden has made it clear that the withdrawal agreement, which set the stage for Britain's formal departure from the European Union, must be respected. This means Biden doesn't like a no-deal Brexit at all. Meanwhile, Biden speaks very proudly of his Irish roots. He has made it clear that the 1998 U.S. brokered Good Friday peace deal for Northern Ireland must never be violated. That, some believe, is a warning against a bill pushed by Johnson that would violate parts of the EU divorce agreement governing the border with Ireland. Biden's stance may weaken Johnson's position in talks with Brussels.
And we've got a much closer relationship between the Democratic Party and Brussels. So this is going to be bad for Britain, no doubt about it, when it comes into next year. But don't forget, this deal has got to be signed by the end of 2020. And so Trump is still going to be president at that point. When the negotiations are going down the line, that's one of the reasons why I think the European Union will be doing everything it can to make sure there is no deal at the end of the year.
Top EU negotiators know all too well that the balance is changing. The British Premier now has to perform a delicate balancing act. He has to come up with a way to pressure Brussels that does not antagonize Biden. Johnson faces a mammoth task. Is he up to the job? The British Premier faces a race against time, as any agreement has to be ratified by the European and British parliaments before the looming deadline.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Over the past two decades, China has emerged as one of the most important markets for Latin American countries. China has developed three distinct pillars for its policy on Latin America: purchases of Latin American goods, Chinese investment in Latin America, and Chinese political solidarity with key Latin American governments. China and Russia have openly spoken out against the U.S. unilateral sanctions against Venezuela and the Chinese government is currently holding talks with Venezuela about a new oil for loan deal. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Vijay Prashad and John Russ. This article is published under the heading, China Working to Expand Ties with Latin America. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. In mid-January, 800 people gathered at Mexico Ministry of Economy to celebrate China Day with a seminar on Chinese-Mexican relations. Mexican Minister of Economy Graciela Marquez Colin, who had a PhD in economic history from Harvard University, said, China and Mexico have to work together to build a stronger and more solid relationship. In July, the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement went into force. At the January event, Marquez Colin said that despite this agreement, Mexico must redouble its efforts to draw investment from other places such as China. Zhu Qiqiao, China's ambassador to Mexico, said his country agrees and has many plans to invest in Mexico, including the $600 million needed by the state-owned Dos Bocas petroleum refinery in Tabasco. This money was put together by the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, the Bank of China, and other international partners. On June 4, 2019, just after he arrived in Mexico City, Ambassador Zhu wrote an opinion piece in a leading financial newspaper, El Financiero. The trade war, he wrote, will not stop China's development. Faced with risks and challenges, China has the confidence to face them and turn them into opportunities. The U.S. and Chinese economies, he noted, are highly integrated, which will make decoupling next to impossible. Meanwhile, China is prepared to increase its interaction with other countries either through investments into those countries, such as Mexico, or by welcoming investment into China. China, he wrote, is not the author of this trade war, and China would like this conflict to end. Three pillars of China's approach. China has developed three distinct pillars for its policy on Latin America. Purchases of Latin American goods, Chinese investment in Latin America, and Chinese political solidarity with key Latin American governments. Over the past two decades, China has emerged as one of the most important markets for Latin American countries. For example, in 2019, 32% of Chile's exports went to China, 29% of Peru's, 28% of Brazil's, 27% of Uruguay's, and 10% of Argentina's. In November 2019, Bolsonaro met with Chinese President Xi Jinping, who said China and Brazil would increase their trade on an equal footing. Brazil simply does not have the latitude that Australia has, since Australia, reliant on the Chinese market, nonetheless joined with the U.S. in a military alliance against China known as the Quad, along with other countries. Finally, on the political front, China has indicated in various diplomatic forums that it will provide a shield as much as possible to prevent regime change operations against Cuba and Venezuela. China and Russia have openly spoken out against the U.S. unilateral sanctions against Venezuela, and the Chinese government is currently holding talks with Venezuela about a new oil for loan deal. China maintains very close ties with Cuba. When Fidel Castro died in 2016, she went personally to the Cuban embassy in Beijing to pay his respects. By bowing three times, Castro is the only foreign leader who has received this treatment. In September 2019, U.S. President Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka visited Argentina. She traveled to Jujuy, which is toward the border with Bolivia. Ivanka Trump went there with John Sullivan, then Deputy Secretary of State, and other members of the U.S. government from the Defense Department and from the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. She met in Parma Marca with Jujuy Governor Gerardo Morales and then alongside David Bogian of the U.S. government's Overseas Private Investment Corporation, OPIC, announced $400 million toward road construction along what is known as the lithium routes. Argentina with Bolivia and Chile form the lithium triangle. This was widely seen across the border in Bolivia as a statement about the MAS orientation toward China. Bogian transitioned OPIC into its current incarnation as the International Development Finance Corp. The DFC's project, known as America Grace, is directly designed as a challenge to Chinese governments and investment in Latin America and the Caribbean. In September, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Guyana, where he championed the investment of ExxonMobil and other oil companies into South American country. Pompeo said Guyana should make a deal with U.S. oil companies, which he claimed are not corrupt. "You look at that," Pompeo said in reference to the record, "and then look at what China does," implying that Chinese companies are corrupt and that a country like Guyana should shun China. On April 26, 2019, Kimberly Breer, the Assistant Secretary for the Office of Western Hemisphere Affairs in the U.S. State Department, made a full-fledged attack on Chinese investment in Latin America and the Caribbean. The Chinese, she said, came to the continent with bags of cash and false promises. She made sly allegations but did not back these up with any factual examples. None of these attacks on China make much headway in Latin America. For example, a Pew survey from 2019 showed that 50% of Mexicans had a favorable opinion of China, while only 36% had a favorable opinion of the United States. More Mexicans had a favorable opinion of President Xi than of President Trump. In September this year, Luz Maria do Mora, a senior official in Mexico's Ministry of Economy, said China is a great example for Mexico. Luz Maria de la Mora, senior official in Mexico's Ministry of Economy, said, "China is a partner to boost our economic recovery and help Mexico emerge from the pandemic as soon as possible. There is no doubt that the United States of America is and will be for a long time Mexico's largest trading partner, but the new affinity between China and Mexico, particularly because of next year's anticipated economic growth in China, is also very important. Despite pressure from Washington, and there is no indication of a major change when a new U.S. president takes office in 2021, these Latin American countries such as Mexico know that they cannot break with China. That would be reckless."
The Julian Assange extradition hearing has been dubbed by many observers and those who care to report on it as the trial of the century. I was there at the Old Bailey in London, and I witnessed firsthand the hearing unfold. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States is charging Australian journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange with 17 counts under the Espionage Act, each carrying with it a maximum sentence of 10 years and an additional count under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, carrying with it a maximum sentence of 5 years. If Julian Assange is extradited to the United States, he faces up to 175 years in a maximum security prison. All of this for the crime of journalism. The successful prosecution of a journalist under the Espionage Act is unprecedented. If convicted, this will have grave ramifications and far-reaching implications for journalism worldwide. On the morning of September 7th, 2020, Julian Assange was rearrested in his jail cell just as his hearing was set to resume at the Old Bailey in London. He hadn't seen his lawyers for 6 months due to COVID restrictions, and communication with them was extremely limited, making it virtually impossible to coordinate any sort of defense. Julian Assange's defense team made it very clear to Judge Baretzer the obstacles that Julian was presented with this entire lockdown. They asked her for more time, that she adjourn the hearing until January 2021 so that he could build a better defense, even though this meant more time in solitary confinement for Julian Assange. She refused the request and proceeded anyway with the hearing, even though it was based off of a new superseding indictment submitted by the United States prosecution. This superseding indictment was given after the deadline and after Assange's defense team had already submitted their evidence and defense arguments. So even though these were the same 18 counts, this superseding indictment had only one goal, which was to make Julian Assange look more sinister and nefarious, so that if he were to be extradited, this would lead to far harsher sentencing in a U.S. court. Now, there's no denying that if Julian Assange is extradited to the United States, he will almost certainly be found guilty, not because he did anything wrong, but because he faces an absolutely unfair trial. The indictment against Julian Assange was returned by a federal grand jury at the Eastern District Court of Virginia, which is also known as the Espionage Court. This is the place where all indictments are cooked up and served to journalists and whistleblowers and people that the United States seeks to make an example of, such as Chelsea Manning or Gary McKinnon or Lori Love. Moreover, the jury that will try Assange in this show trial will be made up predominantly of people from the U.S. intelligence community, including the CIA and the NSA and the Department of Defense. And they will most certainly convict him because he committed the unforgivable sin, which was to expose the United States and their war crimes, their torture programs, and show the U.S. empire for what it is, a bloodthirsty machine that goes around the planet kidnapping and torturing and killing people. One of the media partners that helped expose these crimes is Iraq Body Count. I spoke earlier with Josh Dougherty, who's a senior analyst and researcher from Iraq Body Count, about the impact of these files.
You know, usually with mass graves, they found the number in Iraq during the war, but it was usually dozens, hundreds. So 15,000 would be, you know, like hundreds of mass graves. So to have that sort of reveal at one time in a collection of hundreds of thousands of documents is really huge.
The cables that you worked on with WikiLeaks, the Iraq war logs, how did they affect the perception of the Iraq war in the public sphere, in the public eye?
It turned sentiment away from the war, in terms of against the war, but I think that was already happening to quite a large extent over the years as it got worse and worse in the 2004, 5, 6, 7, you know, sentiment turned away. And then I think that the war logs kind of just solidified that again.
It is extremely evident, just by the very nature of the files that WikiLeaks published and the crimes that Julian Assange exposed, that his persecution is purely political. Julian Assange is being charged under the Espionage Act, which since its very inception has always been a political tool designed to silence political dissidents. It was used against Eugene Debs, a presidential candidate who spoke out against the First World War and the draft. He was stripped of his citizenship and jailed for 10 years. It was used against Daniel Ellsberg, who worked on the Pentagon Papers. It's used arbitrarily against journalists and others who go against the U.S. empire. We mustn't forget that until his arrest in 2019, Julian Assange, when he was dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London by the Metropolitan Police, his only crime in the UK was jumping bail. Within 15 minutes, a judge declared him guilty and sent him to spend 50 weeks, the maximum sentence, in Her Majesty's prison, Belmarsh. This is a Category A maximum security prison where only terrorists and the worst of the worst are sent. That alone tells you everything you need to know. He was given the maximum sentence so that the United States Department of Justice would have ample time to prepare this indictment against him, and surely enough, it came. In court, we heard stark reminders how several officials from the Trump administration have publicly commented about how they want to go after Julian Assange, not because he actually committed any crimes, but because this is a political witch hunt. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in 2017 said that WikiLeaks was a, quote, non-state hostile intelligence service. Former Attorney General Jeff Sessions clearly pressured the Eastern District Court of Virginia to serve this indictment against Assange. And Donald Trump himself has gone back and forth and flip-flopped on his story regarding Assange. In 2010, he said Assange deserves the death penalty. Then in 2016, he said, I love WikiLeaks. And then in 2019, he said he doesn't know anything about WikiLeaks and he's never heard of it. At one point, Judge Baretzer even inquired whether the U.S. presidential elections on November 3rd would impact the case, and said that she would only give a final ruling after the elections. She inadvertently admitted that the trial is political. We mustn't forget that Julian Assange is an Australian citizen in the United Kingdom. He is not American, he has never committed a crime in the US, and he does not owe anything to the US. Nonetheless, the United States is reaching its tentacles all the way across the Atlantic and trying to kidnap a journalist it does not like because he exposed their war crimes. So while they're charging him under U.S. law, they're also denying him any privileges and rights under U.S. law. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that Julian Assange has no First Amendment rights because he's all the way in London. So why are they going after him if he's all the way in London? As I said in my statement outside the Old Bailey, this might be the city of London. The court might be physically located in the U.K., but it is the United States that is holding the gavel. And let it be noted how on the very first day, over 40 human rights organizations and observers and NGOs and MEPs had their access revoked to the trial so that we could not watch what was happening inside of this hearing. During the extradition hearing, we had a total of 47 expert witnesses that were called to the stand. Three of them were called by the prosecution, but all the rest were called by the defense. So every time someone would take the stand, we'd see the same pattern from the prosecution. James Lewis, QC, who was heading the prosecution, would come and ask if they had been paid to testify on Assange's behalf. He would then cite public comments or even petitions that they had signed or open letters as proof that they were somehow biased in Assange's favor. Then we would see the prosecution try to attack the expertise of these witnesses and their respective fields. Highly embarrassing moments, which pointed out how hollow the entire case being put forward by the prosecution really was. And then all of a sudden the judge, Judge Baretzer, says that we're out of time and she wants to rush through all of the witnesses. And so this culminated in seeing the defense having to scramble to summarize witness statements into written form instead of having witnesses come and testify and read them out as fast as possible so that they may be submitted into the record. You must remember that the witnesses were also lumped with hundreds of documents, sometimes 24 hours before they were set to testify by the prosecution. This was a dirty tactic among many used by the prosecution. You know, at first they would argue that Julian Assange was somehow not a journalist. And then they would argue that even if Julian Assange is a journalist, there's no law preventing them from prosecuting journalists. Just brazenly trying to make this point. Then, of course, it came to the issue of Julian Assange's mental and physical health. You see, this was a necessary evil because although these were highly personal matters, his defense had to argue this in court because under Section 91 of the Extradition Act, one can block an extradition if it poses a significant risk to the defendant's physical and mental health. And of course, the prosecution attempted to refute all the diagnoses. They attempted to say that Julian Assange does not have Asperger's and that if he does have depression, well, it's a mild depression, not a moderate or a severe one. They tried to downplay the great risk of suicide that an extradition would pose. And then, of course, when it came to the special administrative measures, these inhumane, draconian conditions that are nothing short of torture, They tried to downplay these SAMs. You see, Julian Assange will be subjected to these extremely draconian and harsh conditions before he's even convicted of a crime. And he could spend years in pretrial at Alexandria Detention Center. Conditions that are so harsh they drove Chelsea Manning to attempt suicide. And if convicted, he will almost certainly be sent to ADX Florence in Colorado, which is a federal super maximum prison. And we don't even have to wait for Julian Assange to be taken to the US to be tortured, because he's already in solitary confinement 23 hours a day in Belmarsh Prison, which the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture described as the following. He said Julian Assange showed all the symptoms typical for prolonged exposure to psychological torture. Right now, Julian Assange is freezing with no heating in his jail cell. Every single day before he was set to appear at the hearing at the Old Bailey, he would be stripped naked and searched and x-rayed and then transported in an upright coffin to the courthouse, an hour and a half and an hour and a half on the way back, every single day. Is that how a civilized nation and a democracy treats journalists now? Perhaps the most explosive witness testimony that we heard throughout this entire hearing came on day 17, when we heard from two former employees of UC Global. UC Global is the Spanish firm that was hired to originally protect the Ecuadorian embassy, but then ended up working for the US intelligence services and spying on Julian Assange and every single person who dared to even visit him or walk through the doors of the embassy, dismantling the phones of journalists, photographing their passports, and violating their privacy like you would not believe. They also discussed a plot to kidnap and poison Assange and make it look like an accident. They even recorded these conversations with his lawyers, violating his legal privilege, which is enshrined in Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which violates his right to due process under US law, which violates British common law, which violates the fundamental principles of any legal system. But moreover, they took all his personal effects when he was arrested in April of 2019, meaning that any trial Julian Assange would face in the United States is already tainted and using tainted evidence and should be thrown out by any judge with a shred of integrity. I was sitting in court right next to Fidel Narvaez, the former consul to the Ecuadorian embassy, when we heard from these former employees of UC Global.
Those testimonies in particular, I am very familiar with, because I am basically a witness in the criminal case that's taking place in Madrid against UC Global. So I have previously seen, and I had access to plenty of evidence of the espionage, of the spying, in terms of videos, audios, documents, and all sorts of activities, illegal activities taking place in my embassy. But personally, what impacted me most, and what should have a lot of importance in this proceedings, I think are the medical reports on Julian, the diagnosis that has been carried out by the highest specialist in the UK regarding his condition, his basically the risk of suicide if he is extradited and subject to those inhuman conditions that we know for sure are the conditions in the supermax prisons in the US system.
These witness statements from UC Global, we only heard about them on day 17 towards the end of the hearing. Do you feel that they got enough attention in court? And also, do you feel that they got enough attention in the media?
No, they didn't get the attention that they deserve. Not at all. It was pity that we couldn't have the witnesses giving testimony, live testimony on camera, because that would have more impact. And they didn't have the attention that they deserve in media as well, because basically this is a political case, and I think the main playing field is outside the court, is public opinion, is what the establishment in the UK decides to do in order to put pressure on the judge, or in order to stop the extradition or to extradite him. This is going to be decided outside. That's my opinion. So even if the testimony has had attention in court, the more important thing is that they are covered by the public opinion, that the media report on them, and that doesn't happen.
Fidel, how optimistic are you about Judge Barreto's ruling?
I would say that I feel more optimistic after seeing so much evidence against the extradition.
Right.
I don't think how she's going to justify extraditing Julian after so much evidence against the extradition on her table. Yeah? So the medical condition is undeniable. The inhuman conditions in U.S. prisons are undeniable. The spying on him and on his legal team carried out by the United States, I think is obvious. Yeah? So I don't know how she's going to justify extraditing him. So if she wants to get out of the political pressure, because there's a lot of political pressure on her, she has the tools, she has the resources, she has the judicial cards to play well. So I'm a bit more optimistic.
To me, the most shocking aspect of this entire show trial was how the court, the judge, this entire institution of supposed justice completely glossed over all of the war crimes and atrocities that were uncovered by WikiLeaks publication. All of the Iraqis that were killed by the US-led invasion, all of the people that were tortured and kidnapped, this was glossed over as if it meant nothing, as if their lives meant nothing. The people who committed the war crimes get off scot-free, but the journalist who exposed their war crimes is being held in a maximum security prison and facing 175 years in a US prison. Is this what they call justice? Not once did we hear the names George Bush or Tony Blair or Donald Rumsfeld mentioned in those halls of the Old Bailey.
Nobody from the Bush administration was ever prosecuted for anything having to do with the Iraq war. You know, people involved in the Admiral Graves scandals, in Haditha, and all these things never got, you know, they never got sentences anywhere near what they were trying to impose on Chelsea Manning, on Julian Assange. And, you know, there's a glaring inconsistency with that. It's that, you know, it is definitely that, you know, committing war crimes and atrocities is somehow much less important than exposing them to the public without the government's permission.
And of course, another allegation that we always heard is that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange were so callous and so reckless, and they endangered the lives of informants. Even though the Department of Defense themselves acknowledged during the Chelsea Manning trials, no one has ever been harmed by WikiLeaks publications, not a single soul. But the very fact that this court is giving more importance to imaginary informants while forgetting about the millions of people killed and displaced by the wars that the UK and the US started is so disgusting. I will never forget that feeling of witnessing this charade and this mockery of a show trial. Just to further disprove this allegation that WikiLeaks was somehow reckless in its publications, I spoke to several journalists who worked directly with Julian Assange and with WikiLeaks on these cables, including Stefania Morizzi, including Josh Dougherty from Iraq Body Count, and they all told me the same thing, that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks enacted the most strict and highest operational security and attention to detail in redacting cables.
At that time, I spent about 2 months in London with all these other groups working on the documents. And, you know, the idea that it was that WikiLeaks or the other partners were callous about it is ridiculous. It's not true at all. It was actually a very big issue. You know, WikiLeaks was taking the issue very seriously. The other media partners were taking the issue very seriously, from my observation.
I spoke also with Andy Worthington, a British author, historian, and journalist who is one of the world's foremost authorities on Guantanamo Bay and the United States torture and rendition programs. And he explained to me how the United States was locking up innocent men and torturing them for absolutely no reason.
Prisoners seized in wartime are supposed to be actually held under the Geneva Conventions and protected by the conventions. But that didn't apply. The Supreme Court realized that men in Guantanamo, who were very loudly complaining, you know, I did nothing wrong, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, I was caught by mistake. There was literally no way that they, no forum, no procedure that they could go through to enable their case to be reviewed so that the United States could admit that it made a mistake and let them go. At some level within the establishment, and I would say we'd be looking here at the CIA, maybe even at the Defense Department, wanted Guantanamo to carry on, and still want Guantanamo to carry on, because of the huge luxury they have of a prison where they can hold people indefinitely for the rest of their lives without any form of due process.
Andy, what precedent do you think this will set for press freedoms if we're jailing people who expose war crimes as opposed to those who actually commit them?
It doesn't really bear thinking about. The difference between dictatorships and countries that claim to be liberal democracies is that there has always been this tacit understanding that if people expose wrongdoing on the part of their governments, then the person who exposes that wrongdoing can be prosecuted because they generally will have broken some kind of agreement that they had regarding secrecy and confidentiality with the government. But that if they then leak documents to any kind of publisher who then publishes those because they are in the public interest, then that's simply something that you have to put up with in a liberal democracy, because it is one of the few things that distinguishes us from dictatorships.
Perhaps what disgusts me just as much as this blatant glossing over of war crimes is the fact that the vast majority of media did not even bother covering this extradition hearing. This extradition hearing, this attack and persecution on Julian Assange, poses the gravest threat to press freedoms anywhere in the world right now. If the United States can reach its tentacles across the Atlantic and just pluck journalists it doesn't like and put them away in jail for two centuries, what's next? The vast majority of independent media did not cover this. Only myself and perhaps a dozen other journalists actually took the time to cover this with detail and care on a daily basis from start to finish. This is no time to be silent, because silence is complicity, it is cowardice, and it is unacceptable. Fidel, do you feel that the media reported on this case adequately or fairly at all?
Not at all. This is the more important case for freedom of expression in a generation. So it should be widely covered by media. It should be widely covered by media. And it's not. Not at all. Despite not being covered, what I haven't seen in the last 4 weeks is negative coverage, which was previous the trial. You had some negative coverage about Julian, about if he's journalist or he's not journalist, about all the smears and defamation campaign launched by his enemies. But I have not seen for a long time a negative attack on him, on his personality. I have not seen an opinion piece saying he should be extradited. So that makes me feel a bit more optimistic about this.
So we will wait and see what Judge Bretzer rules on January 4th at 10 a.m. at the Old Bailey. And this will most likely go to appeals regardless of what she decides. I'm just hoping and praying that this case is thrown out by a higher court or the European Court of Human Rights, and that Julian Assange is not extradited to the U.S. Julian Assange cannot be extradited to the U.S. If he is extradited, he will most likely be convicted. And this will have such grave ramifications for press freedoms, not just in the U.S. or the U.K., but all over the world. We cannot...